Good evening, Larry.
Well, hello, Andy.
How's it going tonight?
It's just going great. It's the best day of the rest of my life.
Have you taken a trip over to that bridge yet?
I have not visited that bridge, but I've seen many pictures of it, and it does appear very persuasive.
It appears persuasive. It's 600 feet?
Yes, it appears that anybody who would take an unexpected drop from that would not survive.
So it would be sufficient and efficient at eradicating breath from your lungs.
Yes, the Rio Grande Gorge Bridge, for those who don't know, is notorious for having no survivors for the people that have gone over the sides. Even the Golden Gate can't claim such an honor. It has had one or two survivors.
But that drops you off underwater.
Yeah, water's quite a bit softer than bedrock.
No doubt. Unless you land the right way. If you land on your back jumping that far, the water would destroy you.
I was going to say, water is very hard when you're coming down from a great height.
But if you went...
How you land. Yeah.
I don't know the physics behind it, but it seems that if you went like kind of like a missile into the water, like your toes stretched out and held your nose and your private parts, I don't know. It seems like you would make it in. Seems like it. I'm not going to try it, though. Anybody want to write in and tell us?
I don't think anybody's listening has probably had that experience to know.
I don't think so. Please consider making us part of your podcast diet. You can find us at Registry Matters on your smart speaker or podcast app of choice, like Google Podcasts or Apple Podcasts. Also, if you like what you hear, please write a review. If you don't forget everything I just said, you can support us at patreon.com/registrymatters.
Well, you said that, but how do our listeners receive notifications about new episodes?
I'm glad you asked. So on the website, there is a little box on the left side below some of the other icons. Click over there. So you're going to go to registrymatters.co and you can click there. And when a new episode is released, you will get an email notification.
And when do they get that notification?
I usually release the episodes at 11 o'clock on Monday night. So you would have it that night and you would be able to pick it up first thing Tuesday morning.
Alrighty. Well, that sounds good. I think I'm going to register to hear what we've talked about.
That seems sort of nepotism-ish, incest-ish.
Well, I need to know how horrible I sound.
All right. That's enough of this. So from ColumbiaMissourian.com, extremely complex sex offender residency restrictions are challenging to enforce. This article goes over that all the different restrictions that have to be monitored, like in my state, if you got sentenced before 06 and then between 06 and 08, and then there's another batch, there's like four different levels. They've got to figure out all the various different compliance restrictions. So this article is covering some of those discrepancies in how different people have to be treated. And in the article, Detective Tony Perkins says he spends 40 hours a week running offender registration and profiles. Four times a year, seven more defectives. That might actually fit. Seven more detectives join him for door-to-door check-ins. Four school officers also help out during the summer. But for the most part, it's just Detective Perkins. That's a lot of resources spent to run around and try and figure out who's living in the right place, who's home by curfew time and whatever. For what?
Well, Andy, it keeps the community safe, according to the proponents.
Where do you think they get their information about the recidivism rate, the likelihood of reoffense, anything of that nature?
They have the same information we have. But as I've said on previous podcasts, one of the structural flaws in the registry in most of our states, but it's in all of our states, that it's a law enforcement function. If it was truly a regulatory scheme, it would be handled by a regulatory agency. But the structural flaw in most of it is that it's handed off to an elected official. Sheriffs are elected. And if they don't call it a sheriff, they have something similar like a constable or something,
constable.
But they hand these functions off to a person who's elected. And as long as the public believes it's keeping them safe and they want their elected sheriff doing these things, it's very difficult for elected sheriff to push back. It does happen from time to time. There was one in Oklahoma, I think, in the Tulsa area that had the task of monitoring registrants, and he spoke out publicly at the end of his career about how misguided the policies were. But they do these monitoring all these restrictions, and it's gotten to the point where I don't even know how in a metropolitan area 7 detectives would be enough, because you're also monitoring their social media.
Right.
They not only have restrictions on where they can live and where they can be present. They have extreme restrictions on who they can contact with, have contact with on social media. And depending on how stringently you're going to monitor your caseload, the caseload would be very small, depending on how many, that would require a lot of detectives. The money comes from the taxpayers, who appear to be more than happy for it to be spent to do something that does only one thing, and that makes you feel good.
Right.
But there's no evidence to show that it does anything to improve safety. We get on the Halloween gig at Marcel about the same resources spent on traffic and being out with the kids on Halloween would probably save more than that mythical one, because we can't even find any history of the mythical one.
Right.
That was molested on Halloween.
Sosin puts out an article. I don't know if they just regurgitate the same one, but I've read it a handful of years where they, at least like a day or two after, they call the newspaper articles the day after to see how many kids were killed in a hit and run accidents. And maybe it's 10 or something like that. And not a single kid was abducted by anybody on the registry. So perhaps it makes just a teeny bit more sense to put out some traffic cops, because you know that there's, I don't know, 100 million kids running around collecting trick or treats.
You do indeed know that, and we know that. I can't say with specificity how many are killed, but there are children hit every Halloween.
But if it saves only one,
well, that would be the argument that should be made in terms of allocation of the resources. But the public feels good about the sex offender scare. I keep saying, to chagrin of a lot of people, that they're reflecting us back. The officers,
yes,
the elected people, are a reflection of us. When people start calling their elected sheriff and say, Madam Sheriff, Mr. Sheriff, if you continue to do this, it's going to be difficult to support your next reelection.
Right.
Because this is a total waste of resources. But I can assure you that very few calls like that go to the elected sheriffs.
Right. I'm definitely with you on it. It is not the politicians' fault for who they are. It is our fault for who they are.
And that discombobulates and frustrates some of our listeners, because they don't understand why we don't understand that the politicians are grandstanding. But grandstanding only works to a receptive audience.
Right.
You can go into the deep into the Bible country and start saying, I want a campaign to outlaw certain things about religious freedom, and you don't get a lot of applause, and you would not win an election. That only works if you campaign to people who are receptive to what you're hearing. So this grandstanding, as we refer to it, it's only grandstanding because it's connecting with you, the voter.
Yeah,
that's the only reason it's grandstanding. and they get mad when we say that. If you're a liberal progressive and you go into the panhandle of Texas where oil is their big business, and you say, I want to transition this country to alternative fuels away from these dirty old generation sources, you just don't get a lot of applause. So that you could grandstand all you wanted to, but you wouldn't get any votes.
Right.
Because that would not be reflecting the will of that part of Texas. If you go into Austin, by the other hand, you would get a lot more receptivity to that message, because Austin's a lot more liberal. A lot more progressive people in Austin around the college and university, and you would have some identification with that message, but not in the Texas Panhandle, you wouldn't. And I'm not picking on you in the Panhandle, though, but just drawing an analogy.
Right. This next article comes from truthout.org. Florida inmates demand wages and higher wages for labor while incarcerated. Mm-hmm. They went on strike. They placed some of those making the demands in solitary. I say that'll teach them. This is about fighting the fees that force prisoners to pay for their incarceration. This is insanity. How do you say, look, I'm not going to go to work, and then they just take you off to solitary as a punishment for you not going to work to support the operations of the prison? There's no, if they're forcing you to work and you're not getting paid, how is that not slavery?
Well, you could argue that it's involuntary servitude, but when you're sent to prison, that's a component of your punishment. Often it's sentenced to 10 years of hard labor or whatever. And it's a political decision whether they want to pay inmates for their services. And I guess Florida would be one of those states that doesn't. I didn't read this article in its totality. Did you get a chance to read over the Florida pay?
Yeah, I mean, they're one of five states where prisoners receive no money for their work, forcing families to cough up money for food and necessities. Florida is also one of 43 states that charge prisoners for their so-called, quote-unquote, stay behind bars. I didn't realize that it was 43 states that charged you to stick around.
Well, I'm not sure what the status is on how much of that's collected. It's one of those things that sounds good to the voters when you say we're going to make them pay and we're going to make them pay. And the people that are costing us money are going to have to pay. Very little is actually collected.
What it does do,
though, is it saddles people with a civil judgment. So it digs the hole deeper for them to try to climb out of. You get out of prison and you get handed a bill for a right amount of money, and then they take a civil action against you for not paying it. You're judgment proof in most cases, but then you have that judgment hanging over you, which a judgment looks bad. At that point, you combine the felony with a recent judgment. Our country, Andy, has gone nuts when it comes to this type of stuff, to charge people. Co-pays are very common for medical care. I think we talked about that preparation for the show.
Yes.
That co-pays have become so prevalent, which means if a person legitimately needs to seek medical care, they end up owing money. And if they manage to convince someone to send them $25, then it's all been devoured by the couple of times they've been to the doctor and got a prescription.
Then they might say, like, for your, you know, in Georgia, they do a Christmas package, then they'll do like a spring package. So you get a package of special goodies twice a year. Maybe if you're negative on the books, they won't allow you to get a package.
I hadn't heard that one.
I'm pretty sure I remember hearing that before I left. Here's another good little quote. It says, in 1984, Michigan legislators approved a measure authorizing counties to charge prisoners up to $60 a day for housing and to file civil suits to retrieve the money.
I saw that, and it's we did the same thing here in Albuquerque. Our mayor, the former mayor, Marty Chavez, tried the same kind of shenanigan when he was mayor, and he didn't collect any money. The bureaucracy of attempting to collect it cost more than the actual revenue that was brought in, and they finally dismantled the attempt to charge the county. I think it was $40 a day here, but whether it's 40 or 60, it really doesn't make any difference. Who can pay it?
Right. That's actually a pretty steep cost. I don't even want to really put a price tag on this, but how would you ever possibly do this other than to go to the other extreme and say that it is somehow a failure of society to quote unquote program you to live within it, within the boundaries that we established to live productively together. Yes, certain people fall outside of that, but it feels to me that it would be on society to grow you the right way to work within it. If you fall outside of those, it is still on society to figure out a way to most appropriately reprogram you for when you are released.
That's kind of radical thinking, Andy. You're saying that you're almost implying that we benefit as a society if we try to recover the human being and produce a unit that's more functional. That sounds kind of progressive, doesn't it?
I think before I left in 2008, I think I was on the other side. I was like, feed them bread and water, chain gangs. I was of that mindset. I had no empathy. I had no understanding of the destruction that goes on inside. And I personally feel that I'm unique in my ability to weather the storm, and I didn't succumb to what they were doing in there. But if you're not of a self-motivated kind of mindset, an autodidact would be a word of self-teaching yourself, then you're just going to succumb to your surroundings. And here you are strapped in a room with 80 other people that think the exact same way as you do. All you're going to do is learn how to throw dice and play parlay and watch BET or watch some sports on TV. That's all there is to do. How does that prepare you to come out and get a job, pay some rent, get some taxes, and prepare for some sort of retirement and take care of your family members? How is that possible?
But I don't think we've connected the dots with the public. I don't think the public realizes that every dysfunctional unit is a drain that could be potentially a productive member and a contributing member. When I use the thing in my capital that if we relegate people to second class status, their contributions into our tax systems that we depend on as older generation, when we have our paws out to collect, there won't be anything there. We're a whole lot better off, but I don't think we've been able to connect the dots that they realize that. If you've got 2 million people incarcerated and all but a very slim number of them, and I'm talking about nationwide, over 2.6, I think, or 2.4 million people incarcerated, they're coming back to the streets someday. Are we better off as a nation with those 2.6 million people being better equipped to work and pay taxes? Or are we better off as a society if they're pushing a shopping cart around with their hand out and contemplating criminality? And it doesn't take a lot of rocket science to figure out which way we're better off as a society. How much money can 2.6 million people living a productive life contribute?
It just feels like on the flip side, you've just said that they are a broken person and they deserve nothing further from society to get straight.
That's our attitude, that they should have gotten it growing up. There's a lot I hear from people who don't have any experience with dealing with offenders that they had an opportunity growing up and they should have taken advantage of it.
Right. Of course,
they should have. They should have.
They didn't.
They didn't for a variety of reasons of our failure of our social safety net. People do grow up in dysfunctional homes. They grow up in one parent homes. They grow up with people using abusing substances. They grow up without anybody contributing to trying to help them become a good citizen, and they grow up in dysfunctional environments, and they become more likely to be a dysfunctional unit themselves. But that's not to our advantage as society to say, well, all right, you had your chance. You had 18 years. We offered you 12 years of education. You didn't take advantage of it. You're done.
F you, kick rocks, move on. But now you end up on the inside of the system. So where would be the next logical progression? If you have decided that you're going to wash your hands of them, what happens next?
What happens next is what we have now, the revolving door, Andy.
I mean, to me, it seems like it would be more efficient to then, if you're convicted of a crime, it's just a death sentence. We'll move to the Judge Dredd model that, I consider you guilty and you're executed on the spot. I'm being incredibly extreme and almost tongue in cheek and just laughable. But as opposed to having the revolving door and spending all the money for it, why not just end it on the spot?
Well, we have a little bit of a problem with capital punishment is losing popularity, and it's less and less used in this country. And I hope that I see in my lifetime the total eradication of capital punishment. I don't think that's a viable model, but we're relegating them to something similar. If you go out and talk to homeless service providers, they will tell you that a large segment of the people they're dealing with who are chronically homeless is because of a criminal record. That's not the only component.
Right.
They're dealing with substance abuse. They're dealing with PTSD. But a significant number of them are former offenders who just cannot reintegrate into society.
Let's move on.
Yeah, well, I did notice that Illinois legislature did pass a bill to repeal pay to stay, and the governor vetoed it. Bruce Warner, I think, he did veto the attempt to repeal pay to stay. So you can conclude that at least the majority of the Illinois Assembly gets the picture, but unfortunately they elected the wrong executive.
Right, right. All right, then. So what do you have for me there next?
How can our listeners call in the show and ask questions or leave a comment? We have a lot of people out there who want to talk to us. How do they do that?
They're going to call in. Just pick up your phone, the old, what is it called? The most efficient form, the most inefficient form of communication, and dial 747-227-4477.
And we will play them on the air if they're good and audible.
Yep, absolutely. All right. Well, this next article comes from myfox8.com. This could be Jorge, but I'm going to say it's George. George Porto Sierra, accused of trying to burn several sex offenders to death at motel. Larry, this asshole set a motel on fire that had people on the registry living in it. He broke a window to pour gasoline inside. When he was asked by the police why he didn't carry out his plans, he said, "You guys got here too soon."
Well, at least he was clear on his intentions.
He said, "I'm going to kill you, child molester," as he cracked the window. And he was carrying a cigarette. And he also was accused of pouring gasoline on a car, too. Because after you're dead, you sure as heck don't need your car anymore.
Now, where did this happen at, Andy?
This is in Florida. Osceola County, Florida.
Osceola County, Florida, yes.
So that's just awesome. That's just awesome. And this is totally an effect of there being a public registry. You could have been convicted of mooning somebody at a college football game or something like that, and you got yourself on the registry. You could have been like the woman in Virginia and didn't report some sort of sex crime going on or sexual act going on between your kid and his girlfriend. And now you're on the registry. This guy pulls up the website, sees you on it, and says, "Oh, hell no, I'm not having that in my neighborhood," and goes and burns the joint down.
We've had so much vigilantism through the years, murders and attempted murders, and because of the public registry. I think the most notorious first earlier ones was in Maine, but they've been in Washington, South Carolina, and there's so many of them that we don't have the ability to directly connect to the registry because the law enforcement apparatus always proclaims unless the person does what this guy did and said, "I'm doing it because of the registry." They always proclaim that there's no direct connection that they can discern, that the person just happened to be on the registry. But the proof is there that the registry is a platform, a tool that people use for vigilante acts. And I don't know the motel is probably a lower end motel.
Right.
Probably. Because most people that live in a motel setting don't have gobs of money. They're looking for something that fits within the residence restriction, which is Florida is laden with. They have a state restriction and a local. They have many localities that impose restrictions greater than the state law. So he may have had these people that were living there may have had no option other than a rundown lower dollar motel, and then a person says, "Oh, well, there's sex offenders here, so I'm going to burn the joint down to get rid of them."
Mm-hmm.
I don't know where. What do they do? They're relegated to living in a dive motel or the streets under the bridges. I think Miami-Dade County was just kicking them out from under from their tent camps.
275 people living in a little tent compound.
I don't know what happens next. They're going to burn them out or evict them.
And yeah, like you were just saying, if they had $2,000 a month of disposable income to afford to live someplace, they're not picking the dive motel. They're not picking a hotel, period. You could live in a different place more readily, in a better environment and so forth. But they are kind of, that's like their last option.
Generally, it is the last option. And the people, when we talked about the dysfunctional people in society, the low dollar hotels often is the last stop before the street.
It's fair.
They find a way to live at a rundown motel in an older, seedier part of town. And the urban renewal planners are running those people out of business. And it pains me as a progressive to have this discussion because I recognize that I don't like people living in substandard conditions, but I've taken many polls in my day when I was in the housing business, and I've never found a person who preferred homelessness. So the facility may be substandard. It may not be ideal. And the balancing act society has to do is to figure out what is too risky to have people living in these places, because you're certainly living on the street is laden with risk. You've got the risk of the elements, the risk of the physical attacks, the risk of all sorts of exploitation when you're on the street.
You can't collect any sort of property because it's going to get stolen.
And if you have substandard wiring or substandard heating, if it's carbon monoxide asphyxiation is a possibility, you would want to close that unit down and close down that heat source. But even substandard hotels, I've always found were preferable to the streets. And I urge caution. When we're going to displace 100 people at a rundown hotel, just ask ourselves, where are they going to go?
Yeah.
What are we going to do next?
And I've been doing a lot more activity on Twitter lately. If you can follow us at Registry Matters on Twitter. And some guy, he took this guy's mugshot, this Jorge or George Porto Sierra, and he captures a clip of his the article title of him being accused of burning the hotel. And he posts, what'd the guy do wrong? Now, how many likes did he get on Twitter, do you think?
He would have gotten a lot more likes than dislikes.
He got 250,000 likes.
And how many dislikes did he get?
It doesn't work that way. You just thumb something up.
There's no thumb down on Twitter.
There's no thumb down on Twitter. So that's a lot of people to have exposure to see it from that one individual for them to chime in and say that they were in favor of his comment that way. That, I'm not saying anybody likes somebody that's a sex offender. There's just more to the story, and people can be treated and people can move on and go to the next chapter. And if everyone wants to just throw them under the bus and eradicate them from the earth, well, then bring back the firing squad, because there's 800,000 of us that you got to get rid of.
Well, I'm going to take a little bit stronger stand. I find it repugnant.
It is.
250,000 likes. To say that what's wrong when someone's burning someone's home down,
yeah,
at the risk of burning their innocent lives. That entire hotel wasn't occupied by people who had done anything wrong.
Correct.
I just see that the fact that he got 250,000 likes shows that we've got 250,000 dysfunctional, misguided units out there that would do a thumbs up for a comment. Oh, what did he do wrong? That's just mind boggling to me.
It is spectacular, possibly deplorables.
I would agree that those 250,000 would fit into a deplorable category.
This article comes from jdsupra.com. Never heard of this one. Can you fire someone for being a sex offender? This article was talking about how when you have a job and let me word it this way. In working a job, you and I are sitting there and we're working on a manufacturing line together, and you're screwing in your widget and I'm screwing in my widget. Do you have any reason to know or care about what my background is? I'm there. We're both pulling our $8 an hour job. Does it matter what my history is?
Good question. It matters to the employer.
I get that. I see that they have a right to know and they can make the decision one way or the other. But this is if in the process of your employment, you disclose the information. If you've lied about it, that's grounds for termination. But should you be fired from the job because after the fact they've hired you, you're doing a good job, then they decide, oh, this is causing conflict, and now they decide to get rid of you?
I'm going to have fun with this one because I'm a consultant, and I just consulted with an employer in the last 2 weeks about this very issue. And as I believe that our audience generally bends conservative, most people don't believe on the conservative side of empowering the government to tell the business how to manage its internal affairs. right to work is the buzzword for union busting, and right to work states and employment at will. Right to work and employment at will is the buzzwords for conservatives. That's their mantra in terms of employment relations. Employment at will gives an employer the right to terminate anyone for any reason other than something that's prohibited by law. And since being a convicted sex offender is not, as far as I know, in any state, there's no protection for that subclass. You can't turn around and say, well, the big bad government should come in and protect people from being fired. And if you're either for employment at will or you're for government intervention. But you can't have it both ways. Most states are employment at will. If you don't have a collective bargaining union agreement or an individualized contract, you are at the will of the employer and they can terminate you for any reason. So being a sex offender is a reason.
Sure.
Right?
I mean, it's a thing. I don't know if it's a legit reason, but it's a thing.
Well, it's for any reason or no reason at all.
Right.
Having conflict, if the word gets out within an employment setting and people it would be really spectacular for the government to say, I don't care if you've got 42 employees that are unhappy and you've got 17 of those that are ready to quit. We're going to force you to employ this person. That would go contrary to most conservative doctrine, I would think.
Right.
So I would say the answer is, absent a collective bargaining agreement through a union, with the protections that come with those bargaining agreements in terms of due process after being hired, absent an individual contract, and absent a federal or state law protecting you, absolutely an employer can fire you. Am I advocating it? No, because I don't want the email that's going to come in. I'm answering the question, can they do it? The answer is yes, they can do it.
Which almost goes back to the housing problem. Now they've lost that job. It's already hard enough with various work restrictions, distance, proximity kind of things. And it's shitty. It's just bad that because someone has pink hair, they're ugly. It seems really crappy that you have someone that is in good standing and they end up getting outed as being on the registry and that you would then turn around and can them.
Except for the reasons that it's in your interest to do so. If the employer knew about it and did not anticipate that there would be this much problem, they may have had their head in the right place, but they can't deal with the turmoil that's causing. And there again, we wouldn't want the big old bad government to come in and force them to encounter lower productivity and a work slowdown because of forcing them to keep someone on the payroll, would we?
No, absolutely not, because the government should intervene. Private sector knows everything best.
That's generally what people of conservative leanings believe.
Yes.
I don't agree with it, but that's generally where they come from. That the government is the source of the problem. Government staying out of thing is generally the solution.
I have a question for you.
I have no answers tonight.
All right. Well, so you're driving down the road and it's getting kind of late. You're getting tired. The sun's down. Your eyes are tired. And you decide to find the next available hotel. Do you think it's important to find out if there are sex offenders living in the hotel?
It had never crossed my mind in the many hundreds, I don't know how many hundreds, but certainly well over 100, maybe multiple hundreds of times. I've never given that a lot of consideration. I don't think people do give that a consideration.
In the numbers of hotels that I've stayed in, the doors are pretty strong. I mean, they're pretty solid doors, generally speaking. Go to a lower end hotel, I'm sure it's not quite as solid, but if you're in a halfway decent hotel, it's a pretty solid impregnable door.
Well, not to mention all the vast surveillance apparatus that any type of hotel at the roadside level and up, the branded hotels, the Holiday Inn, you name all the roadside hotels, the Quinta, they have a massive internal surveillance operation going on these days.
So this is from NBC Chicago. What to do to make sure your family doesn't rent a hotel room next to a registered sex offender? I have multiple things to ask about this. Does it matter? Don't rent the hotel room. Do you think that someone is going to break into your room and abduct your children? I mean, seriously, you're in a hotel. There's 100 people there. There's 500 people there. Do you just see people running around with kids tucked under each arm running out of the building? What? I can't figure out what the threat is in this context, that this matters.
It's the boogeyman, Andy. If people are staying at a hotel that are on the registry, you know they would be up to no good. Because why wouldn't they?
Why would they stay at the hotel versus going out and finding their own place to stay?
Right. Why would they stay in a hotel?
They probably like that they have room service and maid service. So I don't see how you don't ever hear a story or any sort of video surveillance footage of some dude walking, running out of the hotel with a kid tucked under each arm as he's abducting them to try and make his hasty getaway. How does anybody care? I've never considered, well, I wonder who's staying next door. I wonder if they're a pedo. It just never even crosses my mind.
I've never given that any thought, but it's the fear, Andy, of I mean, we could spend a whole episode about what's wrong with our media apparatus in this country, and it would devour the program, probably multiple episodes. But they live and die by ratings. They have to come up with things that make people want to watch and want to listen. And this is something that sells. Until it stops selling, the media is not going to stop doing it. So we've got NBC5 in Chicago running a story that's creating that no one's ever thought of. Now, people are thinking about it now after they've run the story. And they've hit a chord because there are people out there saying, gee, I never thought of that. How safe am I at a hotel?
You almost would have to think that the hotel lobby would be like, whoa, 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 whoa. Don't run that story. We don't want that information to go out.
I'm quite sure the hotel lobby didn't like that story once it ran. But the repercussions could be enormous. There could be a backlash where hotels feel like they have to do more screening and more exclusions, because if Channel 5, NBC5 in Chicago gains traction and they get a lot of positive feedback, they will stay on the story as long as people are wanting to hear about it. I said a few episodes back about why we cover the royal family. It's because people want to hear about it, the royal family.
I'm looking at the comments on the website.
If people want to hear this story, If people want to hear this story and it has legs, they will stay on it and they will contact hotel industry, tourist industry. They will ask them for their comments and what are they doing to keep families safe.
I need to reach out to this. I'm gonna tweet to her when we cover this. But so here's a comment from somebody. These poor reporters. I have to think that many of them actually have brains. So these idiotic stories and reporting must literally eat at their souls. I do feel sorry for them that they have to deal with such stupidity on a daily basis. And it says then that the vast majority of people in the U.S. are just so incredibly brainless that they eat this stupidity up. I think that's...
Now who said that? I love that.
That's a comment on the article from somebody. There's a couple other ones, and they're not in support of the article either. They're telling them that they're stupid for writing an article like this.
Well, it's needlessly causing people to have consternation that they would have never thought of. I've never checked into a hotel and thought much about the things I think about. Don't have anything to do with who's so much inside the room is what's the neighborhood like? What's the security lighting like? How well kept is the facility, which is going to tell me a lot about the management of the hotel. If the exterior lights are half not working and the carpeting's falling apart and the coffee is a black layer in the bottom of a pot that hasn't been changed all day. I kind of get a picture about the facility I don't find it very appealing.
Right.
And you would know intuitively that a place like that would probably have some people staying there that you probably wouldn't want to have as your neighbors. So definitely. You get in your car and you leave and you go to a place but if I'm in a place that I feel comfortable, that feels warm and inviting, I don't give any consideration to who's there other than there might be a crowd of people there of a group of some kind, which can be a problem because you can have a rowdy group.
Right, but it's, you know, 12 o'clock at night, or you're tired. You're there to spend the night and move on. Or, and that's not always the case. That's not why people only stay at hotels, just like the conference coming up in whatever, 3 weeks. We're there to do our business and have our meeting, and we're get out.
Well, NBC will have to check their ratings and see how they're doing, if they're trying to pull themselves out of the cellar, or what's going on.
And another one from the same state, from Clicked on Detroit. Neighbors in Brandon Township worried about safety. It looks like a pretty nice house here, Larry. And somebody set up a group home. I couldn't quite get details out of the article on how the house came to be, but a person puts the house on the market, and then now there's a whole cavalry of sex offenders living across the street in this nice neighborhood. They should be ashamed of themselves for trying to live in a decent house.
That does look like a nice house. That kind of looks like your house.
Oh, yeah, totally. We're paying tax dollars to live in a safe area, and that's not the case now, says a resident.
And a cavalry of sex offenders.
Cavalry. There's two, I think it said.
Oakland County community are furious after a loophole in state law sex offenders and former criminals to move into an adult group home.
Where are they? They've got to go somewhere. Don't you want to then mold them to what nice people live like? That, like, you know, you see all their cars leaving at 6 and 7 o'clock in the morning to get to their 8 o'clock jobs. Isn't that the kind of model that you want them to see, what normal, and I say that with scare quotes, but isn't that how you want people to live?
I'm suspecting there's more to this. When it's an adult group home, these are probably people who have various levels of disabilities.
Could be.
In addition to their criminal history.
And then a neighbor said, I'm a retired PO. I put people like that in jail. I would never have sold the house to them. Actually, I'm sorry. That's the homeowner that sold the house. Anyway, I just wanted to bring this up, as this is just assholery at its finest.
I have no idea where Brandon Township, Michigan is.
I swear it said, no, okay, I'm sorry. I'm seeing Clicked on Detroit.
It says Oakland County, which is, I think is Detroit. That's where Dr. Gavorkian did his, when he performed his services, he delivered them to the Oakland County Medical Examiner.
Okay.
I think this may be a suburb of Detroit. Our Michigan people can let us know on the podcast, how brain dead we are here for not knowing Michigan.
we should get Josh to chime in.
It's the only place I ever lived where they had townships, where you would be in a place that would be called such and such township.
Oh, no. Pennsylvania has townships too.
Yeah. Well, I've never lived there, but I have lived in Michigan. We had townships all over the place.
Okay. And then moving on from the Collateral Consequences Resource Center. And this is about expungement legislation in Maryland and Oklahoma, where it seems to be mostly on the lower end of offenses, whether that's, you know, writing bad checks or low-level drug offenses, mostly misdemeanors that I read that even in a handful of cases, your expungement proceeds automatically. You don't even have to file for it. And in Oklahoma, they're reducing it from 15 years down to 5, I think it said.
Wow. It said that Mary Fallon signed a bill making felony offenders eligible for expungement sealing for the first time without requiring that they be pardoned.
Right.
Effective November 1st, 2018, a person may apply to the court for expungement for a single nonviolent felony conviction 5 years after completion of the sentence if the person has not been convicted of any other felony or separate misdemeanor in the past 7 years.
That sounds to me like a red state that is embracing criminal justice reform.
It does sound that way. We need to give them a shout out. That is very good coming from a red state.
And Maryland, it sounds of similar, you know, situations.
And that's a blue state, but it has a Republican governor, Larry Hogan, signed the bill.
So
adding felony offenses involving theft, drug trafficking, and burglary. This list of more than 100 misdemeanors made eligible for expungement.
Again, it's all on the lower end of things, but you got to start somewhere. You can't go go after murder and try and do expungement.
It's going to be a tougher sell, but that's your best recidivism offense there is.
You would think that those could then work past that if that's the model, right?
You'd think so. But it looks like this is gaining a little bit of steam because the list of states, according to the Collateral Resource Center, thank them for their spectacular work in this area. But there's a number of Indiana, Tennessee states who are considering that, or Nebraska, Kansas.
All right. So the cynic in me says that they're doing that to free up prison space to not reduce prison population, but to tack on tougher sentences on the high end.
I'm not seeing that so much around the country, Andy. It seems like we've reached the crest. And I mean, I'm seeing it at the federal level. The president ran on the campaign but I'm not seeing that even in red states. I'm seeing that there's a move to make sentencing more rational. Your state is one of those has moved in that direction. And our state, unfortunately, under the former prosecutor the last 8 years who's holding the governor's office, we haven't moved in that direction. We've tried, but we can't get past a veto of the governor or anything we've tried to do. But I sense that the states are ahead of the federal system, and it seems to be across the board, both red and blue states, which is a good thing.
I'm going to throw this out there, and correct me if I'm misguided. I have heard it said that we have 50 little democracy experiments, and it would almost be like capitalism of whichever one succeeds the best. Well, shoot, the state next door would go, well, that worked there, then maybe we should adopt it here. That individual states would be the bleeding edge, and it would take longer for the Fed to catch up.
It seems that way, that it takes a while for the federal officials to reflect the change. I mean, they were kicked and dragging on same-sex marriage. Many states had done it. It's usually the states that lead the way.
And maybe a better, a more tolerable conversation across most people would be about the marijuana legalization.
Same thing. The states are leading the way.
And Didn't A.G. Sessions say something to the effect of he really put some fear into the pot growers like in Colorado and so forth, that they really are like quaking in their boots now?
He's made it clear that he's not convinced, as far as I know, that he's holding the line that we're not going to ease the federal restrictions as a controlled substance, and the states that are doing it need to be considering that there may be adverse consequences to them. We'll have to wait and see if with public opinion going against that it's hard to imagine they can maintain that posture.
And is this then, I've asked you this before about a politician, do they merely reflect what their constituents want? So they're just, I don't know, call it an ambassador for their constituents, or do they actually have those beliefs inside? It doesn't seem like Jeff Sessions has any intent. He's had that position for whatever, he's 70 years old or whatever he is. He's held that position his entire life, that even if society moved in that direction, I don't think he would then support it. He would just not attack it and try and tear it down.
Well, in the case of that question, it's both. Some politicians are willing to surrender their political career to do what they really strongly believe in, and if it costs them their offices, so be it. But more often, it's a reflection. You are being elected to represent a group of people, whether it be governor, you're representing all the people of the state, whether it be a state senate district or U.S. Senate seat where you're representing an entire state, or a congressional district, which is a portion of a state, or any number of offices. It's kind of unreasonable to think that the people that you're electing to represent should just stand there and flip the middle finger and say, I'm going to do what the heck I want to do. I don't care what you people think.
Right.
How would that be representation?
And I guess in Sessions' case, he's not representing anybody. He's at the direction of the president.
He is at the pleasure of the president. The president would determine if he accurately represents the view of the administration. This president does not have a total connection with his people. His supporters will support him because of issues that they disagree with, but they like the way he talks.
Yeah.
And they like certain things about what he says. So he can overcome a lot of opposition where people say, well, nope, I don't agree with that. but I'm still for him.
Right.
Because he's kicking ass. He's doing this. He's, and they'll latch onto one or two key issues. And means that he doesn't have to be with them. I think when you and I, Josh, were talking last week, to me, the most important thing for a registered citizen would be their personal safety and to be able to mix with their children and raise them and go to school plays and go to the PTA and have a job and rent a house. To me, that would be a lot more important than Saddam Hussein maybe might come get us someday, even though he's dead. I know that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But to me, all that stuff would be more important than a border wall.
Agreed.
But that's not the way Trump supporters see it. They will latch on to a few issues and they'll say, he's with us on this, he's with us on that, and I don't care about that. My point is on the marijuana, I don't think, first of all, I'm not sure where the president is on that because I've heard conflicting messages. But even if he were to endorse a crackdown on states who have legalized marijuana, I don't think he would be penalized by it because marijuana is not the most important thing to his base. That's right. Not what they view as the number one issue.
I don't disagree with your assessment there at all. Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible. I love this article, Larry. This comes from the LA Times, and its eyewitness testimony is often unreliable, and police and lawmakers know it. I love this article in them talking about, they're talking about scientific principles of using double-blind procedures to have witnesses, have like lineups, I forget the right terms, where they put the six people there behind the two-way mirror or one-way mirror. And some clips in the article says, people are sent away for crimes they did not commit based on testimony from eyewitnesses who were either pressured or gently led into falsely identifying a suspect. I remember, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago, I heard a segment on NPR where they were talking about this subject and the subtlety of an officer leading an eyewitness into that little booth. And they're just these little gestures. Are you sure it's not that one? You know, number three, are you positive? And they totally just in even in non-communication ways, nonverbal, they lead the witness to claim that number three did the deed. And they may even have six guys there that, or six gals, they might even have six people there that had nothing to do with the crime, but now the guy has led them, the police officer has led the witness to point somebody out.
It's even scarier than that because the oftentimes if you do a lineup, there's not a lot of people hanging around police stations ready to do a lineup at the behest of the police. So who do you think stands in the lineup when they're doing these? Do you think it's do you think they go up and round up a bunch of criminals and or how, who do you think? Oftentimes it's cops that stand in the lineup.
Well, I've actually never considered where they got the other five people.
And when you're looking at the cop, with rare exceptions, for those who are old enough to remember the movie Serpico, very few cops look like Serpico did.
All right.
Did you see the movie Serpico?
I did.
Yeah, well, he grew his hair long and he was an undercover detective. But when you're using people who don't look like, quote, criminals.
Right.
They're going to zero in on the person. So if a person who has a criminal history is hauled in, particularly if they snatch them off the street for some misbehavior and take them in and put them into a lineup, the one that's the least well attired is what the average person's going to focus on. Well, has that disheveled look and hasn't shaved for 3 days yeah, that kind of looks like him can be a possibility. The eyewitness identification, there's so much evidence of their unreliability. that I'm surprised that jurors even consider it very much anymore, because it's so well known that people can't remember what they saw 5 minutes ago with accuracy.
That's what we have talked about on a number of occasions of eyewitnesses and how unreliable they were. I think it was two or three podcasts I went on a little rant about it. But we have discussed many times of the witnesses are so revered in the courtroom. Like, oh my God, here's this little old lady and she said she saw the guy. And people are like, oh my God, there's no reason why she would ever lie. We think that our memory and our visual, our senses are just infallible, and they are ridiculously fallible.
They are indeed. And I'll be the first to attest to my lack of, you would not want me as an eyewitness. I see very little. I mean, I have good vision. I can see 20/20, but I see very little in terms of my surroundings. Okay. I'm focused on other things other than what color shirt you're right. wearing and whether you have on a nice watch and whether you have a freckle or anything like that, or what color that hat is. I'm not focused on that. And you asked me, what did he look like?
Yeah.
It was a male.
Yeah.
What was he wearing? I don't know. How tall was he? He was about average height. Mm-hmm. I would be a horrible witness if you tried to pin me down as an eyewitness. If I wasn't prepared for it and something happened quickly, I would not be able to articulate back what happened.
So two bills mandating such procedures were sent to Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, who promptly vetoed them. In the midst of a budget meltdown, the governor said that imposing new requirements on local law enforcement agencies was too expensive. Because of the cost of video equipment and storage, and because the police might have to hire non-officer administrators to conduct the double-blind procedures, later bills never even made it out of committee. We're talking about people's liberties. And as you said in the last podcast, that our founding fathers wanted to make it crazy difficult for your liberties to be taken away.
I did say that.
And I'm inclined to agree with you, but here it is where bills, I'm just going to assume a bill has made it through both sides of the House, except for whatever, Nebraska, where there's one. So they got a majority of legislators to agree on a thing, and they sent it to the governor, and he said no.
Well, this would have to be an old story because Schwarzenegger hasn't been governor for some time.
Yeah, and then the article itself isn't old. They're just bringing that up about the procedures of using double-blind studies, where you take the officer that's doing the lineup, the checking. He is not involved in the case at all, doesn't know anything about it, doesn't know the witness, doesn't know any of the perps in the lineup. So he's just like, hey, is it number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6? I don't care. I don't know anything about it. That's how a double-blind study would work.
Well, the point would be that the legislature has had a realization, and then the governor at that time didn't agree. But do you think he's got his advice from what I call the police, the law enforcement apparatus, or do you think he got his advice from the American Civil Liberties Union on the veto?
Oh, I can pretty much guarantee you that he got it from the law enforcement people.
And he issued a veto. Okay, since Jerry Brown's been governor, what have they done to try to reenact that legislation to see if Brown will accept it? That would be a good question.
And it says it's now time for California to do what it should have done in 2008, require police agencies to abide by a set of standards to protect lineup, photo identification, and other white eyewitness procedures from improper influence. Those overdue mandates are now set forth in Senate Bill 923, authored by Senator Scott Wiener, and Assemblyman Mark Levin. Uh-oh. Watch out. Not your Mark Levin, Larry. Not your Mark Levin.
These are both liberal, do-good Democrats. Wiener from San Francisco and Levin from San Rafael. And it says lawmakers should quickly send the bill to Governor Jerry Brown, who should sign it. Well, we'll see.
Right.
But I can assure you the law enforcement people are not for this, because it's going to be more costly, more difficult. And justice does have a cost.
I get it. I'm just struggling with, if their mandate is to serve and protect, that doesn't mean rake people over the coals, harass people. I'm not saying that 1% of the law enforcement app, to me, the majority of them are doing the right, honorable job. But it's easy for them to influence and be lazy one day, perhaps, and and they don't want to fill out the paperwork or something. And they, you know, I just, they're supposed to do the right thing. We've put those people in those positions to do the right thing, the honorable thing with integrity and honesty.
And many of them do the right thing with integrity and honesty, but they're human and they take shortcuts and there's this thing as the gut instinct, and people believe that they've got the right person. And by golly, this is all just a bunch of red tape and hoopla they're putting me through. I've got my guy. That's what the people up in Boulder Police Department thought with the Ramses. They had the right. They didn't need to be out looking for Dominique's killer. They had him right there before them. Or so they thought.
Yeah.
Until years later, they were exonerated.
I don't know, man. It feels that if they are wrong, there are significantly greater consequences for our side of the equation, not us as registrants or convicted felons, but just our side as the civilians, that they have the resources, the guns, and to make your life very, very difficult, including just at the low end of embarrassing you in front of your neighbors and making a talk and like, oh my God, what did that person do? All the way to the point of putting you on a lineup, and then your picture ends up in the paper and your TV, and you end up on TV, all for an accusation because somebody misidentified you, and they have all those resources. They should err on the side of caution, way more on the side of caution.
And our elected officials have to start hearing that from us.
Oh, it's back to us.
It's back to us.
So elections have consequences.
Like, we have a sheriff election coming up here in my county, many counties across the country. 2018, you'll be electing a lot of sheriffs around the country.
Okay.
And when your sheriff is running, when you tell those candidates, our sheriff is dead set against body cams. And I disagree with our sheriff on that. I have full support of body cams, but there are some issues related to the body cams in terms of when they should be. There are moments where officers can encounter you where you would have an expectation of a little bit more privacy.
Fair.
And there are things that you would not want put on available. If these are public information, which they are, if you can go down and buy the footage and retrieve it, then we have to have some controls. But the law enforcement would be better protected if the officers were using them. Our sheriff needs to be hearing that, the current sheriff who's against it. He needs to be hearing that we disagree with you, sir. We think officers, for their own protection, as well as us as citizens, should have this technology. It's low cost, and there's more good that comes from bad. But our sheriff isn't hearing that, apparently.
Right.
And that's what needs to be happening on this legislation. Governor Brown, if this gets to his desk, he needs to be hearing from He needs to get a bill that's almost unanimously passed with bipartisan support, to the extent that there is bipartisanship. California Assembly is overwhelmingly Democratic. But to the extent that there are Republicans, there are probably a third of them Republicans, they need to be bipartisan. And we need to convey to Governor Brown, this is important. This is what the people want.
Right.
And if Governor Brown hears that message loud and clear, it may be that it doesn't meet with the same thing that Schwarzenegger did with the veto. He may say, law enforcement, I'm sorry, but this is sound public policy. I will sign it.
Right. Here's a quick little update from the Miami Herald. Homeless sex offenders lose court fight to keep Hialeah tent camp. Where to next? Our next article is going to be a fun one. But this one, so here you got 270-something people. But the Miami-Dade judge on Thursday cleared a way for the county to dismantle a tent village of homeless sex offenders outside Hialeah, and a lawyer for some of the residents said the ruling leaves them no choice but to live on a roadside or a street somewhere else. I know we were talking about this just a little while ago, and then also, I don't know, sometime last week, I think it was in Argentina that the building burned down, the homeless building where they were squatting. Was that?
Yes, it was in
Brazil. And you were just talking about maybe substandard living conditions, and what are you supposed to do? Would you rather live in substandard living conditions, or would you rather live out in the elements? I think I would take a substandard building versus on the street. Obviously not an ideal situation. And even Josh said last week, he said, I can't believe I'm sitting here rooting for them to keep their tent city. This is just sad.
It's tragic, tragic.
They have to live 2,500 feet away from schools and all those other places. That has to make that county just about unlivable.
Particularly since that's one of the most urban places in Florida. It's Miami-Dade County.
Yeah, that's where Hurricane Andrew like rolled right through, right?
I believe that was back in 92, yeah. I think.
So it's very flat. It's a well-populated area. What are they supposed to do? Larry, if someone called you and they were describing their situation, do you have any suggestions?
Well, the only suggestion I can make is that, to the extent possible, get out of Miami-Dade County and try to find a place where the residency buffers are much shorter, much smaller.
I think also says in there, so the minimum in Florida is 1,000 feet.
1,000, that's the state rule.
Is a Florida Action Committee, I mean, how much involvement do you think they have in this?
I know that it's a high priority issue for them with their limitations on resources. Yeah. That they have, but that residency restrictions are really tragic because those people that were, I mean, they've been moved out from under the Julia Tuttle Causeway some years ago, and they're like nomads looking for a place to pitch a tent.
Right, right.
And we talk about what compassionate Americans we are. And I would urge the people in Florida and living in Dade County to take a look at yourself and ask yourself, really?
Yeah.
Am I really the compassionate person that I say I am? These people have paid their debt to society and they're trying to reestablish their lives. And if you believe what you say you do, you can't be comfortable with what's happening to your fellow human beings.
You know, you said something talking about, I don't know if it was last one or 2 weeks ago, if you were somehow banished from going to the state capitol to support or oppose legislation. You said something to the effect of, I dare you to try and stop me.
I would disregard that without any hesitation.
This next article.
One of the fundamental rights you have is to petition government for redress of your grievances. And I would absolutely disregard that.
This next article then comes from NBCWashington.com. So this is in the DC area. Sex offender kicked out of a meeting sued Stafford County School Board. He was going to a school board meeting at a school as a registered sex offender because there were some disciplinary issues that he was having a problem with. And he's a member of the NAACP. And as he's trying to go into the school, a county police officer escorted him out.
I think that he's going to have a potential for an action there. These are public meetings.
But if you're prohibited from going to schools, parks, daycares, blah, 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 doesn't that prevent you from doing something related, ancillarily? Oh, I can't say that word. Ancillarily related to school. I mean, he's there for a disciplinary issue relating to the school, but it's not during school hours. It's not during a school game or anything like that.
It would be where I think that there would be a good cause of action for him. That is an elected body and they're conducting official business, and to make that, to conduct business in a place where the citizens don't have access to for whatever the reasons is extremely problematic. I would definitely seek a legal representation. I hate to say contact the ACLU because I don't know that they would take it, but I would definitely contact.
Well, I mean,
attorneys and see if they can find some way to represent.
He's an African American. I gotta think that the NAACP would stand. It feels like that would be something that they would stand up if a black guy is getting kicked out of a school trying to exercise his First Amendment rights. I think that they would jump. Somebody would jump in.
I'm not so sure the ACLU would see it. I mean, the NAACP would see it as a racial issue. He wasn't getting kicked out because of his race. They would jump on it then, but he was getting kicked out because he's on the registry.
True.
Right?
Yep.
But where is this Stafford County at?
I can't speak to where it is. I just know that it's coming from the DC area. I'm not familiar with it. It could be on the Virginia side. I'm from that area. The county name doesn't ring a bell for me. It's Stafford County, Virginia.
Well, the person I know, he's listening to the podcast, so he should call us and talk about
okay.
it. What was that number again?
747-227-4477. How'd you like that, man? Just rolls off the tongue.
We will seek to find you representation if you're listening to our podcast.
Excellent. Oh, you think Narsal would step up?
I don't know that Narsal would, but me personally, I would seek to try to find him a representation for this. I can't speak for Narsal because we collectively make decisions individually. No one has the authority to make this, but it would be well received by Narsal, I can tell you that.
He does have representation, and the attorney said you have a registered sex offender who has totally changed his life around. For him to have his freedom of speech chilled, that's a big deal. His crime was in 04, so it's been 14-ish years since his crime took place. He served 30 days in jail for indecent liberties with children in an online chat room 14 years ago.
So he does have representation. He is going to seek legal redress.
Yes. That's good. Maxwell Sokol is the name of the attorney.
That's good to know.
So help me decipher this. It says that's an incorrect reading of the statute. The statute prohibits him from being on a school campus. But if the school is hosting something that is not during school hours, does the school campus moniker change?
Well, ultimately, that would be a judicial interpretation of that. He's got a compelling argument that it's not serving that purpose as a school at that time. It is a campus, but it's not being used as a school at that time.
Right.
This would be a good appellate issue, depending on how the lower court rules. And it would be an issue that Narsal would be interested in. Now that I know he has an attorney, that's what I was trying to look up when I kind of lost you.
And our final, and I guess this would be our topic of the night, would be this interview that was done between Ron Book and the ACLU attorney down in Florida talking about the homeless guys that we just talked about a couple episodes ago. And I just got to start. This guy is so angry.
Well, let's tell people who Ron Book is for the people who are not listening. He is the director, chairman of the Miami-Dade County Homeless Trust. His responsibility is to get people off the streets and into housing. He's the person who would be theoretically charged with finding housing for these people who don't have a place and have tents.
Isn't that giving him a lot more credit? Isn't that being very generous with who he is?
Well, that's his official role. Well, he is the executive director of the Miami-Dade County Homeless Trust.
It just feels like that's giving him a very generous title for him being a complete, somebody told me tonight, douche.
For the people that don't know who he is, though, it helps give them some relationship to who we're talking about. If you say Ron Book and nobody's ever heard of him, so that's who Ron Book is.
All right, let me try this again.
Okay, well, let me ask Ron Book about those resident restrictions, because you were very influential in coming up with those restrictions where they cannot be, 1,000 feet away?
2,500 feet of schools, parks, playgrounds, and places where children generally congregate. What a novel thing to do to keep convicted sexual predators,
We have a math, Ron, that shows where they cannot be, and that really excludes a lot of Miami-Dade.
You watch the video. He's almost turning red. He is so angry during this whole segment.
He definitely sounded and appeared that way to me.
Hang on, here we go.
Where are they supposed to go?
Well, let me answer my question completely, because you asked a question. People convicted of sexually deviant behaviors.
So tell me what sexually deviant behaviors could range from.
Well, what he's saying, that he's implying that everything that's got purple in the registry is something grotesque and deviant, like sexual abuse of a child. But unfortunately, he's just deliberately misleading people. There's so many things that you can be on the registry for, particularly in states like Florida that has an expansive list. So he's misleading the people, but the people that they're not familiar with the issue, would the average person would think that you would have to have done something really deviant to be on the registry.
You snatch some little cute little kid off of a school bus and you've got her held captive in your basement.
That would be the impression that the average. I mean, you and I did an interview on a conference call where a person made it clear that her son was not a sexual offender. And I said, well, he's convicted of a sex offense. And she said, well, a sexual offender who's done something, and she described something much more serious than what the average, the sex offense, the people that are out in the public, or the people in the community, well, oftentimes those are the lower level offenses, because people have done all those heinous things. They're still serving long prison sentences. And even in some cases, they're serving long prison sentences when they didn't do anything heinous. Right. Like viewing underage porn, would put you in prison in most states and in the federal system for a long time. So those people are not out. The people who are likely to be out in the community have actually done the more moderate, lower level offenses. That's the funny thing about it.
Right. If they had done something more heinous, they would have a boatload of time. I almost said something profane, but they would be sitting in prison for 20, 30 something years.
Well, yeah, like the people like Mr. Sandusky.
Right.
He was a true sexual predator. Mm-hmm. Former House Speaker Hastert, also by his own admission, was a sexual predator. He was not able to be prosecuted, but he did predation for many years when he coached the wrestling team. Those people typically don't get out of prison. The gymnast coach, I can't
Larry think Nassar.
His name at the moment in Michigan. Nassar, he'll never get out of prison.
Definitely not.
The judge told him. Well, so the true sexual predators are not out in the community. So Mr. Book calls people sexual predators, but there are very few of those actually in the population that are on the registry. And Book knows better than that. He's doing that because he can.
Do you think he knows it seriously? Do you think that he and also the Marcy Hamilton, do you think that they are they living in some sort of parallel universe where they do believe inside that the recidivism rate, 90% go unreported, and the recidivism rate is through the roof? It's just unreported. That's why we're able to report these 3% recidivism rate numbers.
I don't think he actually, of course, no one knows what's in his head, but I don't know how you could actually believe that. That's like asking the executives of the tobacco companies, Philip Morris and Williamson and RJ Reynolds and all those people, if they truly believed that their products weren't harmful when they were saying that. Do you think that they actually did believe that their products were not harmful?
I shudder to think that they didn't know. If they didn't know, then there's something else drastically wrong. But if you know, what the mind can conceive and believe, it can achieve. And if we twist that ever so slightly, if you surround yourself with enough information that says that sex offenders are unreported, our sexual offenses are unreported, you could eventually internalize that, and then you just discard all of everything else. It is the inverse of fake news.
The inverse of fake news. I don't think I've heard that term before.
I just made it up. I mean, he is personally digesting his own reality of fake news, and he believes that it's true. I guess it actually is fake news, not the inverse of it. He has created this alternate reality where the stuff is true, and then he actually believes it and drives that bus along that bus line.
Well, he would have to truly believe what he's saying. He would have to have totally tuned out everything. And like I was making a comparison with the tobacco executives, when Surgeon General issued his report in 1964, they had that information. They had to have been in denial or deliberately misleading. They knew that scientific evidence had shown there was a direct correlation between tobacco use and severe health side effects. And they couldn't, with a straight face, tell you that we don't believe our product is harmful. They can tell you with a straight face that we believe our product should be left up to the individual choice,
right,
for the person to do this. And the information's there, and if they choose to do it, that's fine. But for them to say that there's no direct, they've maintained until this tobacco settlement in the 90s, yeah, that there was no link between the side effects, until they finally were driven to submission by what was going to be awarded by runaway juries. If these cases had gone to trial, there was like dozens and hundreds of them that were working their way to their attorneys could not keep them. Shield them indefinitely. They were already suffering some high dollar awards.
Yes.
And that's why they entered into the settlement with the state. Money that's been paid out over 25, 30 year period for the harmful health effects and what the states have paid out to care for what they couldn't have not believed. I don't know how Ron Book, who is supposed to be an educated man, could believe that the people out on the registry have all done predatory behavior. He couldn't believe that. All you have to do is look at the list of what's on the sex offense, of what will get you on the sex offender registry. You look at the list, it would take you 5 minutes to look at all the list of the offenses, and you couldn't believe all those are predatory offenses. Could you?
Maybe if you just see sex offender, you just think child molester, and that's as far as you get, and everything else shuts down. I don't know. I don't see how you could. I don't see how you can get there unless you just, I mean, he's terribly guilt ridden. And here I am doing some armchair psychology here, but he's just angry. And perhaps it's because he feels all this guilt because his daughter was a victim some dozen, 20 years ago.
Well, that's a possibility, but I tend to, when people that are educated don't know any better, I tend to not give them the benefit of the doubt when they, I think they know when they're choosing to, I think he's choosing to do what he's doing.
Well, let's keep going.
And he comes across as a mean
person. Oh, he's horrible, but let's go.
Ought not live in close proximity to where children are on a regular basis. That's first of all. Second of all, you can show me this concocted map that the American Civil Liberties Union, the far left thinking individuals.
Every time I hear it, the far left thinking individuals about this map, it's so funny. He kills me.
Well, that is what the average American thinks of the American Civil Liberties Union as a far left group. But go
ahead. It's almost like there's spittle coming out of his mouth as he's saying it.
Who think that criminals should come out of prison, especially those who offend against children.
Which, not everybody in prison for a sexual offense offended against a child.
And be restored to their normal rights, not have a registry, not have any restrictions. At the end of the day, we have a map. And our map shows where thousands of predators and offenders that are on the register live in Miami-Dade County. And just two nights ago, when we held our last meeting out there at 71st.
Larry, he is so angry. He can't even formulate a full sentence without, like, breaking up his words. He's so angry.
And 36th Avenue. And by the way, we didn't need to hold one. We've held close to a dozen of them out there, where we bring not only our housing navigators and our career source folks to help get them places to live and provide the financial resources for it. We had one individual who brought 15 addresses the other night, much to the chagrin and disappointment of the ACLU and legal services.
We would be
six
delighted
of which,
if there were six places
of which,
for our clients
six of
to
which
live.
Were Jim. Solid, good addresses, and they went agree. In.
So the person brought 15 addresses, but only six of them were solid.
And solid means that they were acceptable for the within the boundaries of the restriction.
I guess. I mean, I'm assuming that's what it means. So out of 275 people in the tent city, they have found places for six people to live.
Well, that's a start.
Oh, certainly. Six people is better than zero, but you still have, what, 269 people. I think it's 277. So now there's 271 or something like that. So it's 270 something people are still left in a homeless capacity.
Well, now they've been evicted from that 71st mm-hmm. and whatever he said address.
Yeah. And so now the ACLU attorney is about to get in.
Don't want
this.
Them to be housed. They want them to continue
true.
To sit out there in a martyr-like approach
that is
to this issue.
Completely untrue. We want our clients to be housed. There is not sufficient affordable housing in Miami-Dade County. There are 455.
Would you want them to live in your neighborhood?
I'd be happy for anyone who has.
So Ron Book just like snookered at her after the TV show host asked her if she would want them to live in her neighborhood. And he's just like,
ha! Well, you don't get to have control over who lives in your neighborhood. I used to, when I was in property management, I would tell people who didn't like a particular neighbor, whether it be upstairs or downstairs or beside them, I would tell them, I tell you what you can do. You can rent that apartment and we'll keep it vacant. And I never got any acceptance on that offer, but you don't really get to choose your neighbors.
Huh, that's interesting. And we've also discussed you don't have a right to know who they are either.
Well, but choosing your neighbors, I mean, if you believe in the freedoms that you claim you do and what's great about America, why would you want to try to stop someone from having the freedom to buy or rent a place?
They make me feel
oogie.
How can
you justify that?
They make me feel creepy.
And square that with America, basic American values. How can you do that?
Let's hear what the attorney says.
Done his or her time in prison and is now on probation or finished with probation. There is excellent treatment for ex-sex offenders, and the data is very, very clear that there is no relationship between proximity to schools and offending. And in fact, 95% of sex offenses occur within the home.
That's a joke of a number.
That
because what you want people to believe,
Brooke,
you want people. You interrupted me.
It's like in grade school. She did it to me first. This kills me, Larry.
Okay. And you want people to believe that there are low recidivism rates, and you ignore the fact that 90% is underreporting, and there are thousands.
Let's talk about housing. Let me bring in the homeless trust, because you're also involved in that. Residents of Miami-Dade County pay a tax. When they get their property tax bill, I get it, we all get it, and we pay a tax to the homeless trust to help in situations like that.
But they do not
the
help.
The homeless trust, with Ron Book, who has had meetings there, has stepped in and said that they would help these people find homes.
And
why not let that process take its course?
We have. And they've been out there twice, as Mr. Book said. And, in fact, our information is that of the there are 277 people who have residences at that particular encampment. There are 455 total who have transient residences. And we understand Mr. Book has found housing for six of them.
475, did she say?
Well, total with transitory addresses. So that would include people that are living in other transient locations other than that particular camp.
And this homeless trust that collects taxes in the city has found homes for six people. So what else are they doing with the money that they collect with the beverage tax?
Well, I would caution that the need would probably far exceed the revenue that they have. Having said that, I doubt they prioritize the people that are on the registry as far as finding them places because of the difficulty. You're starting with your hands tied behind your head, assuming that you even had the best of intentions, which I'm not going to say that I think Mr. Book does, but you would be starting with your hands behind your head back because of the limitations of the 2,500 feet. If you're dealing with a person who doesn't have that restriction, you'd have a lot more opportunity to house them with far fewer restrictions. So it'd be a more difficult population to work with, even if you were trying.
Yeah.
And that's great. And we are delighted that six people can have shelter.
Out of how many?
There are 277 registered at that particular encampment at the edge of Hialeah, and there are 455 registered transients in the county.
As usual, Ms. Baker and the American Civil Liberties Union uses distorted, misleading, and inaccurate numbers. First of all, what I said was just Monday night, one person brought six addresses. We have relocated many to other communities at our expense.
Here's what I seriously think is going on. This guy is a powerful individual. He has political connections. This is just my sense, and help me fill in any gaps. This guy has used his political connections to create some sort of pseudo nonprofit that has then levied a tax, and they are using that infrastructure to ship the undesirables out of his community.
Good. Well, part of what you say is clearly true. He's politically connected. His daughter, I think, is a senator or a representative. And he's definitely has influence by the admission of the interview that he helped facilitate the 2,500 feet restriction in Miami-Dade County.
And using all of that to effectively make a banishment. And now he has tax dollars coming in to help ship them out of his town.
He did say that, so we're just taking what he said, that we've moved him to other communities. Now, he could be other communities within Miami-Dade County, but it certainly sounded like outside of Miami-Dade County, which would be a form of greyhound therapy, as it used to be called,
fair.
When you shipped your people out to other communities.
I've heard that term before.
And we have found housing for a number of them. So that's first of all. Second of all, let me just, without disrespectfully, correct one thing that you said. When you get your ad valorem tax bill, there is no line on that tax bill for the homeless trust. There are no ad valorem taxes that go to fund the homeless trust or the domestic violence oversight board. We are funded largely with a food and beverage tax that's levied in our community that provides funding both for the homeless trust and the domestic violence oversight board.
This Mr. notion Bork believes that this notion, those who are ex-sex offenders should not get his services.
With all due respect, none of those offenders that have committed acts against children can be cured. No expert will walk into a court of law.
He has just stated a completely.
I have heard Emily Horowitz state that exact thing, though, that they can be treated and treatment works. So he just stated that no expert, and she's a psychologist. Forgive me, Emily. I don't know your exact title, but she's a professor at a college in criminal justice kind of subjects, and she has made that statement that you can be treated and that it works.
Well, I think I've heard that there's a certain segment of the population where it's difficult, if almost impossible, to treat. But that's assuming that everybody needs treatment that's on the registry,
right?
And if you start at the things that can get you on the registry, does a 17-year-old that had sex with a 15-year-old need treatment?
Right.
Is there anything to cure there?
It doesn't seem like there's anything wrong.
Is there anything to cure with a 19-year-old that has sex with a 17-year-old? Is there anything that needs to be treated?
It doesn't seem like it.
Is there anything that needs to be treated about a person who went out streaking? Maybe some counseling, mild counseling about going out and doing indecent exposure. But those type of things could easily be treatable. What about when there's an impulse control issue? A lot of offenses happen because of maturing adolescent who has proximity to a relative and a familial get together. And there's a lack of impulse control and there's an inappropriate touching. There was a temporary aberrational behavior of an otherwise law-abiding citizen. Is there anything there that needs long-term treatment that can't be cured? To hear Ron Book, all those people he's assuming that they all need treatment and that none of the treatments would work for the person who had the impulse control issue.
Right.
The serial predator probably can't be cured. I doubt Sandusky could be cured. Old age will cure him because he'll get to the point where he can't do it anymore. But I doubt with someone who had been going that many years for that long, it'd be probably most difficult, if not impossible. But he's a rare, minuscule part of that population that Mr. Book is talking about.
And the DSM addresses that particular kind of person you just described. And that is literally what the term pedophile is someone that's attracted to young children. But even being a pedophile doesn't mean that you were going to act upon it. Now you've moved into some sort of sociopathic kind of behavior to couple the two together that turns you in. That's got to be a ridiculously small number of people in the population.
It is.
And even those on the registry, streaking, you didn't report your kids having sex, all that stuff, all those things he then says are not treatable. And perhaps he's right because there's nothing to treat.
We should send him a letter and say, you're right. Some of these things that put people in registry are not treatable because there's nothing there. There's no illness to treat.
Right. We just got a couple seconds left of this news segment.
Housing that is available in our community, it's out there and it's available.
And like I said,
and by the way, Elliot, we have provided your staff, your reporters, that had been out at the site as recently as Monday night, they were given the map to show where thousands of them live in this community.
Right, we're going to keep following the story, and there's a lawsuit.
He's so angry. There are thousands, Larry.
Well, there probably are.
Yes, I'm sure there are.
Quite a number of people living in there. But that doesn't change the reality of the situation.
No, it does not. So I did find a quote that I liked this week, and it is, "You can't always choose the path you walk in life, but you can always choose the manner in which you walk it." That is from John O'Leary. I thought that seemed relevant to the fight that we are in.
And who the heck is John O'Leary? Didn't he die back 123 years ago?
I am sure this is an old quote. I just get emails and so forth of motivational quotes, and this one seemed fitting and also related to fight.
Let's see if he died 123 years ago.
Let's see if you two went to school together. That's the question. As always, Larry, I want to thank you.
I may be a little bit older than him.
That's possible. I want to thank you so much for joining us. And another thing, if you need to subscribe to get notifications of it, visit registrymatters.co. You can follow us on Twitter, not on Facebook because of their silly policies. Where else? Dial in 747-227-4477, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. I think that covers everything. That will end the show. And I appreciate Larry, and I will talk to you soon.
Thanks, Andy. Bye.